This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Antoine Fuqua, directed the new remake of the classic 1960 Western The Magnificent Seven. The remake stars Denzel Washington. Fuqua's other films include Training Day and The Equalizer, which also starred Denzel, and Southpaw. The new version of The Magnificent Seven is set in the Old West, in a pioneering town in which the residents are being forced out by a greedy industrialist who owns mines and wants to mine this town. Denzel plays Sam Chisholm, a warrant officer and a licensed peace officer who's a quick draw, a deadly shot, and keeps to himself. When he comes to town looking for the man he's supposed to bring to justice, he's approached by a brave young woman whose husband was just killed by the mine owner's men. She asks Chisholm to protect the town. He enlists six other men, bounty hunters, gamblers, hired guns, each an expert with a weapon and used to facing death. Terry spoke with Fuqua last Wednesday.
Antoine Fuqua, welcome to Fresh Air. What did the original 1960 version of The Magnificent Seven mean to you? And I'll tell you that I saw it when I was about nine, and it was the first movie I went to by myself with friends, without parents. And we took a bus to get to the movie theater, and it was thrilling to be there on our own. And I just loved this movie so much. So tell me what The Magnificent Seven, the original, meant to you.
Well, the original Magnificent Seven had so many memories that I can smell them. it reminds me of my grandmother. On Sundays, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And on Sundays, they had like matinees on TV, and they would play all the different Westerns. And she just loved them. She loved them. I'm not sure if it was her way of keeping me off the streets. I would sit there with her, and she would make me whatever food I want. That's what I mean by I could smell it. She would make me whatever I love eating, and we would sit there and watch different Westerns. Magnificent Seven, I remember specifically sitting there watching that with her, and she loved Yul Brynner, from first time we saw him in The Ten Commandments.
Pharaoh.
The Pharaoh. You know?
And Yul Brynner plays the role that Denzel kind of plays now. It's a variation on that
right.
role. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, the lead gunslinger that takes the job initially, and then he goes out and gets the guys. Yul Brynner's role, and it was fantastic because what I recall about that movie was sitting there with her and listening to her talk about each guy as they were introduced. I recall specifically. The moment when Steve McQueen was introduced. And it didn't really dawn on me the importance of what was saying something about racism or inequality from the first time we meet the guys. The idea that the Native American that had died in the original Mag 7 couldn't get buried in the graveyard where the whites were. And the town folks were hell-bent on not letting that happen. And this guy very casually just says, "I'll do it." And he jumps on the wagon. And then some other guy named Steve McQueen says, "Yeah, I'll go with you." And they jump on the wagon. And they didn't know each other. And these two men decided to take this carriage with this body of the Native American up to the white cemetery and put their lives at risk. And had each other's back just based on two men who saw good virtue, I guess, in each other. I don't know what it was, but that moment really stuck with me, and I didn't realize the impact that scene would have on my life as far as, growing up and seeing people be bullied or, I just didn't have it in me to stand by and watch that sort of thing happen.
Really? Would you would think of that scene in The Magnificent Seven when they took the body of the Native American and buried him?
No, not directly, not that way. It's almost like I realized the impact that it had on me. Mm-hmm. You know how there's so many little pieces that make up a person, and that was a piece that I realized later in my life when I saw The Seven Samurai for the first time when I was in college.
Which The Magnificent Seven is inspired by. That's a Japanese film, The Seven Samurai, yeah.
Exactly, directed by Kurosawa, the great Kurosawa, really. And, it was always the idea of the bully.
Were you bullied as a kid?
No, never. Well, there was a couple people that tried. And, I put a stop to that pretty quick. I don't have that that gene in me where I let somebody take advantage of me that way. Because I'm also the oldest. I have two sisters and a brother. You know, and when you have two sisters with mouths on them, you know, you have to be able to fight. I used to get off the bus and there'd be a crowd around, you know, and I was thinking, God, I hope this is not for me. And it normally was. And it was because someone says something to my sister and the first thing she says is, well, I'll get my brother. And normally it was like the biggest guy. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. But, you know,
yeah,
you had to step up because, that you know, you got to protect your siblings.
One of the messages of the Magnificent Seven is the most charismatic people are on the side of good. Although, yeah, really, the Seven, they're not necessarily good guys. I mean, they're hired guns. They're bounty hunters, you know, but they decide to, this time around, work on the side of good. In the original film, the one that you first fell in love with, you know, there are groups of, like, misfits and gunslingers who decide to save a town, a Mexican farming village, because the village is being attacked regularly by bandits led by Eli Wallach, who need food. And so they just steal the harvest over and over again, and it's killing the town. And so the town asks Yul Brynner to, well, in fact, let me play a scene here from the original 1960 version, when a couple of, you know, of the peasants from this town who are farmers meet Yul Brynner and see that he's a good shot, and they ask him for help. They ask him to help them buy guns to protect the town.
We need help.
We must buy guns. We know nothing about them. Will you buy guns for us?
Guns are very expensive and hard to get. Why don't you hire men?
Men?
Gunmen. Nowadays, men are cheaper than guns.
Would you go? It will be a blessing if you came to help us.
Sorry, I'm not in the blessing business.
No, no, we offer more than that. We could feed you every day.
And we have this.
What's that?
We can sell this for gold. Everything we own. Everything of value in the village.
I've been offered a lot for my work, but never everything.
I've been offered a lot for my work, but never everything. That line is in your remake of the film, too.
It's a great line.
It's a great line. So what are some of the things you wanted to save from the original? You've changed a lot. It's no longer a Mexican farming village. It's now a pioneering town in the Old West where, you know, there's a mine company that wants to take it over. The Magnificent Seven is from different backgrounds in your remake than in the original. So there's differences, but the essence is kind of the same. So what is the essence that you wanted to keep?
You know, I went back and watched Seven Samurai again, and, you know, you go back to the source, and I wanted to understand what was Kurosawa trying to say. And, of course, the word samurai means to serve. And I thought that's the very clear message, is that, you know, we're all here on this earth to help each other, right? And to be in service of others, for people you don't even know. And of course, we know there's men and women that do that today, of course, in our military, and, you know, officers on the street and all that. So I think that's an important message, and that's what I wanted to keep, and the producers and we all wanted to keep, and we did. And then I watched Sturgis's film, and he did the exact same thing. He kept the same idea. The essence remained the same. The simple story of in service of others at your own sacrifice and for no monetary gain, really, because, you know, you'll never probably get to spend that money.
So, you know, it's interesting. In the original version from 1960, Eli Wallach, who is not Mexican, plays the head Mexican bandit.
Right.
Your film is very diverse. You know, you've got Denzel is the lead. And he, of course, is African-American. Among the seven, there's a Mexican, there's a Native American, there's an Asian character. One of the bravest people in the movie is a woman. In the original version, the woman is just like the love interest of one of the characters, and she's like the only woman with speaking lines in it. But in your version, you know, this woman is really brave. She picks up a gun, she knows how to shoot, and she's the person who enlists Denzel Washington's support. So was this your idea to make the movie as diverse as it is? Did that come with the script, or did that come with your casting?
When I first got the script, there was a Native American and there was Mexican. And when I got involved, it kind of came out of just, I was sitting in a room with MGM and Sony, and we were all just going through who would be the best actor, you know, for the lead. Who's the Yul Brynner of the day? Who's the, you know, powerful actor with the gravity and the weight and this? And as the conversation kept going, well, maybe for an hour or so, something just kept pulling at me, and I just said, you know, personally, what would make this an event for me to really want to make this movie is to see Denzel Washington on a horse in all black as a cowboy. And the room went quiet. And then they turned to me and they said, you think you can get him to do it? And now I'm thinking I may have stepped into something because I don't know if he'll do it or not, you know. Because I was pitching it. I was saying, come on, you know, who do we have that has that power? And Denzel just came to mind. I didn't think about his color. It's just Denzel. And once that happened, and he said yes, after I met with him, I flew to New York. We sat down. I played some music that I had on my phone, I think it may have been some Sergio Leone music and the Magnificent Seven song. I had that. And I started pitching him my vision of the movie.
Pitching Denzel?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I started telling, I said, okay, D, and I played the music. We're sitting in a restaurant in New York, and I put on this music, and I know people kind of look around, and I start painting the picture of him coming over the hill, you know, you know, through the heat waves with the sun, and he's dressed in black on a black horse, and he just started laughing. He said, you love Westerns, don't you? I said, yeah, I love him. I said, I just want to see you on a horse. I want to see you do this. And about a week later, he called me, and he said, let's do it. You know, I want to get on some horses and start riding, and, you know. And it just sort of naturally started to fall into place that way. Ethan Hawke basically cornered me in New York for the Equalizer IMAX screening that he was hosting, and he just ruffled my jacket, my nice sport jacket, by the way, and he grabbed me and goes, Magnificent Seven, that means there's seven parts. I know you're talking to Denzel about being the lead, so there's six parts, and if I don't get one of them, our friendship's over. So, you know, of course, I was going to call Ethan anyway because it was a great opportunity to put them together again.
Like, what about Chris Pratt?
Well, Chris is funny because I had a meeting with Chris, and it was great. I loved him. As soon as I met him, he was the best, funny, just charming. And I was like, this guy is the guy. But he had, you know, Jurassic World was coming out, and, you know, he had a lot of offers. And he said, like, I got to meet with a couple of directors about something I've already committed to meeting about, but I loved talking to you, and I loved where you're going with it, and I'll get back to you. I promise I won't hold you up. And he called me maybe a week later, and literally someone in my office said, you know, Chris Pratt's on the phone. I picked up the phone, and he started singing O Shenandoah.
O
Shenandoah? O Shenandoah, yeah. He started singing it. And I was like, I said, hello? And he was just singing, and I said, oh, he's in. So, you know. I was literally holding up my fingers going, okay, Denzel. And I was counting them down like they were doing in the movie.
Exactly. And, right. That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was doing. I was like, he's in. And Chris, he said, I always wanted to be a cowboy. So that was that.
An essential part of any Western is charisma. And Denzel is so charismatic. He's really like iconic in this. And like the original Yul Brynner character, he's dressed in black with a black hat. And Denzel wears that hat with the brim kind of tilted down, and his face isn't even in full view in it. He's not a talkative guy in it. So, like, some of his tools as an actor can't be used to the maximum because you don't always see his full face. He doesn't have that much dialogue, and yet he's so iconic in it. So can you describe working with him to get that kind of, you know, iconic look?
I think what you'd be honest about who he is, right? This particular character has a secret.
Which I'm not giving away.
Right. So some of that is that he has this quiet intensity, and Denzel has that power to pull that off. The thought is that you don't really see him clearly, really. You know, that's why my instinct went to Denzel, because you know the old saying, power doesn't move?
Mm-hmm.
Everything kind of comes to mm-hmm. it. That's Denzel. So a guy like that could just be still and have his hat down low and you barely see his face and you can't keep your eyes off of him.
So you wanted to see Denzel on a horse. I mean, are these Hollywood horses? Are they stunt horses?
A few of them were. Chris Pratt's horse was from War Horse. That was the one Spielberg used. So mm-hmm. he was used to a certain thing. Denzel's horse, I believe, was in a film before. His was a little more complicated because he was Andalusian and he was wiry. And he wanted to fight and run all the time. But a lot of them were stunt horses. But some of them weren't. And the ones that were not were a little more complicated. The stunt guys were amazing because they would just take these falls. They did over 800 falls. There's no visual effects in that. They're falling off those horses. And the horses are running all around them. And when you got 60, 70 of them riding down a hill with guys screaming and guns going off, it's dangerous. And
can I ask you an indelicate question about the horses?
Mm-hmm.
There aren't scenes that I noticed in which there's, what's the word to use for horse poo? Horse manure?
Oh, yeah.
Horse manure. But you have that many horses, you know there's going to be a lot of manure on the set. And and this is the set that the stunt people have to fall off the horses and act like they've been shot or hit mm-hmm. with a bow and mm-hmm. arrow. So really, as the director, how do you deal with all the horse manure?
Well, anybody out there listening that wants to get in the film business, that might be your first job. Because there are some like great young people in Baton Rouge. They're beautiful young boys and girls, like beautiful. And I would see my AD just go, clean up. And they come run out with the shovels. And I'm thinking, they are earning their stripes, these kids. And it was hot. So, 100-something degrees. And they're like, clean up horse poo. and you got to get out there and move quickly because I'm on a schedule.
That's right.
it's funny. We've had a few situations where a couple guys got shot off the horse. And like I said, the horses don't know what's going on. And horses raise his tail up and goes to the bathroom. And the guy falls off the horse and he has to lay still because he's supposed to be dead. It's happened a couple times.
That is a hard job.
Oh, God.
Okay, so here's another indelicate question.
Go for it.
I love Westerns. I grew up with them. And it just always struck me that a lot of the guys in the Westerns wore their gun belts really low. And I was thinking, like, when they're sitting down, that's got to, like, hurt their privates just a little bit. So when you were consulting with people about where did they really, like, what's the authentic way to wear, like, your gun belt, what did you learn about protecting yourself when you're wearing it?
That's interesting. Well, that would be more for the actors because they had to do it. But
it's
their bodies. I didn't interfere with how they protected those private parts. What I realized, though, is that, everyone had a different way of wearing it just based on how they move, what's best for their hand-eye coordination, how to get the gun out fastest. I found that some of them never even pulled a gun out. They shoot, they just reach down and grab the gun and twist their holster and fire right through the holster. So in your mind, you think because we've always shown Westerns that they take it out and shoot. Some of them never took them out. They would literally just bend their holster up and twist it up towards you, and before you realize that they've already shot a bullet through the bottom. Why wouldn't you do that? The logic of that makes perfect sense once we sat there and talked to the guy. He said, well, what would you take it out for if you're fast enough to just twist your holster up?
Can I try to answer that? I would assume that the holster would affect the trajectory of the bullet and that your aim would not be as good if you're shooting through the holster. But what do I know?
That's a lot of power coming out of that gun.
That is true. I want to ask you about Training Day. In fact, let's play a scene from this. And Training Day is about two cops. The veteran cop played by Denzel Washington, who's a kind of corrupt rogue cop, very manipulative of his new rookie partner, who's played by Ethan Hawke. And in this scene, they're both in the car. Denzel is driving. Ethan Hawke is in the passenger seat. And then Denzel takes out a pipe and offers it to Ethan Hawke and asks him to take it, and then kind of tries to bully him into taking it.
To be truly effective, a good narcotics agent must know and love narcotics. In fact, a good narcotics agent should have narcotics in his blood.
What are you gonna smoke that?
Nope, you are.
Hell if I am.
Yeah, you not?
No.
Why, you a Mormon or something? You're Jesus freak?
Nah, man, I'm not losing my job.
This is your job.
I can't do that.
Smoke it.
No.
This ain't a test. Just take a hit. Take a hit.
Man, listen, I became a cop to stop people.
Yeah, yeah, blah, 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 blah. It's not a review board. It ain't cocaine. Take a hit.
No, man. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, right. If I was a dealer, you'd be dead by now. Turn down on the street, and the chief brings your wife a crisply folded flag. What the fuck is wrong with you? Talking about, you know what? I don't want you in my union. I don't want you in my division. Get the out of my car. Go back to the valley, rookie.
Give me that thing. I'll smoke it, man. Give it to me. You want me to smoke it? I'll smoke it.
Smoking it is a big mistake in that film. So
I haven't listened to watched that scene in a long time.
What kind of reaction did you get to Training Day from police?
I thought that they would be upset with me, but they were great. I got pulled over a couple of times, like, you know, speeding or something. I can't remember. And I remember one guy looked and goes, "Antoine Fuqua, you directed Training Day?" I said, "Yeah." He talked to his partner. He goes, "He directed Training Day." They come up, "You direct Training Day?" "Great movie, man. I love that movie." "Slow down." Let me go. You know? Because, you know, cops, and I'm friends with a lot of them, you know, and undercover cops as well. They helped me out with this film quite a bit. They know the world they live in. There's a truth to that, right? And Denzel's character wasn't corrupt as much as he was sick. And cops recognize that sickness. That's a sickness of power. He believes that everything he's doing is for the greater good. He believes that that's how you deal with bad guys, and that's how you have to be on the streets. And he's not wrong, but that kind of behavior without oversight is the problem. That kind of behavior without going to therapy, without being watchdogged a little bit, is the danger.
Antoine Fuqua, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Antoine Fuqua spoke with Terry Gross last Wednesday. Fuqua directed the new remake of The Magnificent Seven. The actor Kiefer Sutherland is best known to TV viewers as the secret agent who helped save the president in the hit series 24. He's on the other side of the Oval Office in Designated Survivor, which premiered Wednesday on ABC. He plays a cabinet member who suddenly becomes president after a terror attack. The show got our critic-at-large John Powers thinking about how television now presents the presidency. Here's John.
Television used to be careful when it told fictional stories about the presidency. It was bound by a sense of decorum. But things changed forever with the famous commercial for the movie Independence Day, which wowed watchers of the 1996 Super Bowl by blowing the White House sky high. Ever since, presidents have been fair game. You can portray them as thugs, schemers, or murderers, or knock them off to boost ratings. The latest show to occupy the White House is Designated Survivor, a new ABC series created by David Guggenheim, best known for writing thrillers like Safe House. To judge from its pilot, the show hopes to capitalize on current anxieties about everything from our divided government to the threat of cataclysmic terror. Kiefer Sutherland stars as Tom Kirkman, a lesser cabinet member who, on the night of the State of the Union address, has been chosen as, well, the designated survivor. That is, he's the one sequestered away so the U.S. government still has a top official to run things in case of a freakish calamity. Naturally, the calamity occurs. To Kirkman's horror, an explosion takes out the U.S. Capitol, and everyone above him in the pecking order. Suddenly, this thoughtful liberal must commandeer the Oval Office during a crisis. Making matters trickier, most White House insiders, from the chief of staff to a presidential speechwriter played by Cal Penn, think he's not up to the job. He's barely sworn in before he's dealing with their machinations. even as he tries to discover whether the terror attack came from the outside or from within the government. Watching this decent, sober man learn the ropes is a bit like seeing a character from The West Wing be parachuted into an episode of Sutherland's old show, 24. Of course, if any actor knows firsthand what it means to step into big shoes, it's Sutherland, the son of a famous and pungent actor who's made himself really, really good, shining in everything from 24 to art movies by Lars von Trier. He's great here, too. In this scene, soft-spoken President Kirkman deals with the Iranian ambassador, who's spilling crocodile tears, and he shows he's prepared to carry a big stick.
Mr. Ambassador.
Mr. President.
Please.
Thank you. Please, allow me to begin by extending to you and the American people my country's most sincere sympathies on this horrific tragedy. If there is anything our people can do in response to this tremendous act of cowardice, rest assured we will do it.
I appreciate that. You can begin by removing your destroyers from the Strait of Hormuz.
Mr. President, excuse me, but I believe you have been misinformed.
Is that a fact?
Yes, we have moved no such destroyers into the Strait of Hormuz.
My Defense Department has war-gamed this out. They're waiting for me to give them the green light, which I assure you I will do, unless you pull your destroyers back to Bandar Abbas within the next 3 hours.
Mr. President,
Ambassador, you may not know much about me, but what you should know is that I'm about as straight a shooter as you're going to find in Washington. So you should believe me when I tell you that I do not want, as my first act as Commander-in-Chief, to attack Iran. But as both of us know, it's not always up to us how history plays itself out. Now, I have chosen to believe that your country is not playing on our emotions tonight, but nevertheless, you will feel the full impact of them if you do not comply with my demands. Mr. Ambassador, dock your destroyers, or the lead story on the morning news will not be about the attack on our capital, but the devastating attack on yours. Please, Mr. Ambassador, let's not get off on the wrong foot here tonight.
Now, fictionalized stories about presidents tend to break in two basic directions. They can be honorably high-minded, like 7 Days in May or The West Wing, surely the purest liberal fantasy ever put on TV. Or they can be gleefully irreverent, even cynical, like Gore Vidal's novels, or the recent spate of splashy hits like Veep, Scandal, and House of Cards, where nobody cares about governing, boring, and no political principles are at stake. While it's too early to know what kind of show Designated Survivor will turn out to be, I'm betting it will ultimately wind up as a steroid-fueled melodrama like Scandal, Homeland, or 24. That's what's currently thought exciting on network TV, which is desperate to hook those watching on their phones. More important, today's Washington shows reflect a general belief that life inside the Beltway is a Game of Thrones. They tap into and reinforce a cynicism about real-life politicians that's heightened even more by news channel pundits who treat everything, even ideas, as a tactic. You don't have to be a political junkie to see how well such an attitude dovetails with our current presidential election, which features two record-breakingly unpopular candidates, both widely thought to be out for themselves. Call me a sucker, but the problem with all these splashy Washington shows is that they tend to make life there seem even more immoral than it actually is. Many politicians, and not a few presidents, seek power to make the world better, even if their ideas of better aren't always mine. That's why I'm hoping Designated Survivor will do something scandalous, or do I mean old-fashioned, and play it straight. I'd love to see President Kirkman survive as a good, unambitious man, one who tries to build something sturdier and nobler than a house of cards.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Designated Survivor premiered Wednesday on ABC. A juvenile detention facility is not typically a stop along the way to an opera career, but nothing in our next guest, Ryan Speedo Green's early life, would have suggested he'd sing at the Metropolitan Opera. He grew up in a trailer park and in a home with bullet holes. Because of his violent temper, he was placed in a special class for problem kids and did time in juvenile detention. But then he discovered he could sing. And although he knew nothing about opera, he was placed in an opera program in a performing arts high school and devoted himself to it. In 2011, he won the Metropolitan Opera's National Council auditions. Now he's in the ensemble of the Vienna State Opera, and he's about to sing in the Met's production of La Bohème. And although he's only 30, there's a new biography of Greene called Sing for Your Life. Terry spoke with Greene last Tuesday and began with his aria from La Bohème, which he recorded for us at a rehearsal.
That's my guest Ryan Speedo Greene singing the Code aria in La Bohème, and that's a rehearsal recording, but he's about to open in the opera at the Met. Ryan Speedo Greene, welcome to Fresh Air. When was the first time you realized that you had this like deep, rich singing voice, that you could get these like beautiful, rich, deep tones? I mean, my impression is that you not only weren't exposed to opera as a child, you had no idea that you could sing.
Well, yes. You mentioned the sound of my voice, the tone of my voice, but it wasn't always this way. When I first started singing, I was singing as a tenor.
No,
In high school.
Okay.
Yeah. So it wasn't until puberty kicked in that I realized that I probably wasn't a tenor. You know, opera was not something that was put in front of me. It was something just I happened to stumble upon by chance. And since I stumbled upon it, it has been my passion and my focus.
So you're a bass baritone. What does that mean?
It means that I'm sort of a hybrid voice type in between baritone, which is the middle voice of the male, and bass, which is the lowest voice of the male, and kind of gives me the opportunity to sing both if need be, because I have a higher range, but I also have a low notes as close to a bass.
Is the bass baritone typically like the villain or the king or the despot?
you have it correct. You know, it's not very often that a low voice in general gets the girl, if you know what I mean. And as a bass baritone or a bass, you tend to be characters that are older or characters of high stature or priestly characters or bad guys. There are very few occasions in opera where you are the good guy. For instance, La Nozze di Figaro. This is one of the few opportunities that the low voice becomes the hero and is the hero. But a majority of the time, you're playing a supporting cast to the tenor or the baritone.
When you started to make your way through opera, did you feel like your background was something you should cover up because people might think that you were not emotionally prepared for it or that, you know, you weren't educated enough for it?
Well, it was even before I got into opera that I decided to push my past deep inside me, because I wanted to only think about my future and moving forward and leaving my past mistakes in the past and worrying about how I was going to better my future. And this happened before I even started singing opera.
So I hope you don't mind talking about your past.
Of course not.
In this interview. When you think back to your childhood and try to understand why you were so angry and often violent, what do you think about? What do you think were like the causes of that kind of upheaval in your life?
You know, it's hard to imagine that the person was me. And honestly, it's sometimes scary to know that person is inside of me. But, you know, I try to use the experiences to add to the depth of my characters and the performances I have. You know, my past is my past, and it doesn't define me. It only gives me fuel for my future.
When you were in juvie, describe what your day-to-day life was like. And how old were you?
I think I was around 11, 12.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going there, and I was, you know, driven in a police car all the way across the state of Virginia in cuffs and shackles. I can remember being in, you know, my cell with it was a small window with that was barred up, and I had a medical mattress. And I even remember being put in solitary from, you know, when I would lash out against the staff and other kids, and they would put me in this solitary confinement room. And I remember the cold cement walls and not wanting to touch them, and, you know, screaming so loud that I lost my, had no voice afterwards, and feeling so alone. You were put in a small unit, and most of your days spent alone in your cell.
So when you were in juvie, what did you think your future was going to be?
Pretty much in the beginning, I thought my future was very bleak, and I didn't really think I had a future. But eventually, the longer I was there, the more that I wanted to have a future, the more that I'd, you know, it was a personal decision to better myself, to make sure that I would never end up back here. And I remember, you know, one of the first moments of me being involved with music, you know, when I had good behavior there, they would give me a radio to listen to, and I would sit in my room and I would listen to the top 40 hits of 1998 and sing along to it in my room. And
what were the hits that you were singing along to?
Oh, gosh. I remember Backstreet Boys and Usher were on the radio then.
Uh-huh.
And obviously, my voice is not one of Usher or the Backstreet Boys, but at the time, I loved singing to it.
I think one of the great things about your book is that it's a beautiful tribute to the power of good teachers who recognize the goodness in troubled kids and find the talent within them and nurture it. Because your book has several of those people in it, and you are very grateful. You express a lot of gratitude toward them. So let's start with Mrs. Hughes, who helped you in the class that you were in for kids who acted up all the time, for kids who were trouble. First, talk about the class and what it felt like to be singled out and put in a special class like that.
Well, you know, I was in a class of six or seven of the most uncontrollable elementary schoolers in the entire district. And I remember the first day I was in Mrs. Hughes' class, you know, this tiny woman with blonde curls. And the first day I was in a class, I threw my desk at her.
Oh, my gosh.
And instead of sending me away to the office to go home like most teachers would have done, she took my chair and said, "You can learn from the floor because that's where your desk is. And when you're ready to learn from your desk, you can have your chair and your desk back." And she was one of the first people in my life to not give up on me and not just see an angry kid and not want to deal with him. She stayed in my life, and she will be there for opening night of La Boheme.
Oh, great. So you're in this class for troubled kids. The mm-hmm. teachers take a special interest in you. But still, you end up in juvenile detention center for how long?
For about 2 months.
Okay. And then you end up going to a high school for the arts. How did
Indeed.
You get in? I mean, you had you shown any previous interest in the arts?
I had joined choir and as sort of like an easy elective because I was interested in playing football. And I thought I had to audition for the Government School for the Arts to get a passing grade in the class. And so this is a magnet school for the arts in Virginia, sort of like the school Fame. And it had an opera program, a dance program, musical theater, instrumental. And so I auditioned and honestly didn't expect to get in. But with, I guess, how worlds connect, my elementary school teacher, Mrs. Hughes, her husband was the principal of this magnet school for the arts. And so when I auditioned, I believe I could carry a tune, not a very good tune, but I could carry a tune. And I believe they were trying to maybe get some kids from my district. It was one of the poor districts in the area. So I think Mr. Hughes maybe strongly suggested that they should give me a chance. And they did.
So this was an opera program, and they needed more boys for it too, right?
Oh, for sure, yes.
Mm-hmm. So did you think like, ugh, I hate this music when you got into it?
Well, I had never really listened to it before, and this is another thing I auditioned
for
the program.
You didn't even have any preconceptions.
No. Okay. Well, I mean, I had preconceptions in the sense that I thought opera was something, you know, what I saw in Looney Tunes. I thought it was like some, you know, big fat Viking lady who's,
you know,
with Norse helmet breaking windows and glasses. And this is what I thought opera was. And obviously my preconception changed once I saw my first opera.
What was your first opera?
Well, my first opera was, and I happened to be very, very lucky and blessed that my first opera was at the Metropolitan Opera. My school, Governor's School for the Arts in North Virginia, they took a trip to New York every other year. And when I was about 15, they went to New York City to see an opera at the Met. And my fourth grade elementary school teacher, Mrs. Hughes, who I mentioned earlier, actually paid for my trip because I couldn't pay for it myself. And my first opera at the Met was Carmen. And, you know, the Met itself is, you know, a magical place. And the night that I saw Carmen at the Met was so pivotal in my life because not only did it break my preconception of what opera was, but it broke my preconception of who could sing opera. And the lead singer in Carmen, Carmen herself, was an African-American mezzo-soprano by the name of Denise Graves. And it changed my life. You know, when I was watching her, you know, I felt every emotion on the spectrum, you know, anger, sadness, joy. You know, she had comic moments. She was also incredibly seductive on stage. And afterwards, I got to meet her because of Mr. Brown, who became my voice teacher. I got to meet her backstage, and she treated me like I was, you know, her best friend's son or her nephew, and, you know, hugged me and called me her boo and took pictures with me. And it made opera something tangible. It made it something real, not something that was a fantasy that I couldn't approach. And so when I left the Met that night, I told Mr. Brown outside of the Met, you know, I'm going to sing at the Metropolitan Opera. I told him this, and he looked at me and he said, okay, Speedo, maybe one day when you can learn to read music, when you can get on stage and remember your lines, when you can sing in a foreign language, when you can go to college, when you could, you know, sing in a young artist program and actually sing some professional roles, maybe someday you'll be able to audition for the Met. And then kind of in my mind, I think I took it all down and made a list, and 9 years later, I sing at the Met.
So when you started singing dramatic roles in opera, roles that required the expression of jealousy, revenge, rage, did you draw on the anger that you had when you were a child? Or if you felt like you put that behind you, did you have to find a safe way of tapping into really powerful emotions for your art?
I'm not a fan of using anger on stage, and I feel like that's not a proper emotion to use when you're on stage performing. I think, you know, when you mentioned jealousy like that, like anger can stem from jealousy, but maybe the jealousy can stem from love, like loving someone so much that if they don't love you back or if they love someone else that you get jealous. And I think a root of my emotions that I use are from those sort of feelings. And I try not to just get into once you get into anger, it becomes a bit uncontrollable. And the anger that I had as a child is not the kind of emotions that I, you know, express today in my life. And no, I don't have to pull from anger to perform on stage. I pull from other experiences, emotions in my past.
I'm going to read the opening line of the new biography of you. So the opening line is, Ryan Speedo Green did not belong here. this is the chapter about the Met audition, about you being at a really nice hotel and how out of place you felt at that time in this world. So when you were in the Met National Council auditions, which you ended up winning, did you feel really out of place, that you didn't belong there? Like, what made you feel that way?
Well, it was a bit daunting to me, you know, being around the best singers in the United States, young singers who were coming from some of the best schools and conservatories in the United States, Juilliard, AVA, Curtis, Boston Conservatory, Indiana Conservatory, all of these great schools. And, you know, I'm coming from a university that's not necessarily known for its opera program. and they're talking about, oh, what professional gigs they had later and what summer programs they were going to and, you know, what young artist programs they were a part of. And I just felt overwhelmed. Like, I mean, I'm nobody. Why am I here? And I was so in disbelief that I was there that I didn't even bring a tuxedo with me because I didn't think that I would even make it to the finals. But as I went through the week working with the coaches, I became more confident. And when I made it to the finals, it was even more exciting for me because then I knew that I'd be able to see my father because my father had promised that if I made it to the finals, he'd fly to New York and see me sing because he had never heard me sing opera.
So you mentioned your father. You had seen your father, I think, like four times before he'd come to see you perform in the opera because he and your mother separated when you were very young and he moved to another state. So you didn't have much of a relationship. What was it like to hook up with him when he actually did come see you and you got to know each other better?
You know, I barely saw my father growing up, but he promised to come to the Met Finals if I made it there. And I remember after my first aria in the Met Finals, I could hear my dad in the audience going, hoo, 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 hoo. And I think that was probably the first time people at the Met had heard appreciation calls like this. And that's the kind of guy he was. And, you know, he was funny and charismatic. He was the kind of person when he would walk into a room, everybody would gravitate towards him and his charisma. And I try and use this charisma and, you know, sometimes his comic talent on stage when I'm performing.
So your middle name, Speedo, Ryan Speedo Green, comes from your father. It was his middle name. He gave you the middle name of Speedo. How did he get the name?
My father was apparently a very fast birth, and he gave me the name for not only that it was his middle name, but for my father was a semi-professional bodybuilder. And I was born on April Fool's Day. So, you know, as a joke, for April Fool's Day, he gave me the name Speedo.
Does it have anything to do with Speedos?
Oh, yeah.
With the brief? Yeah.
Because that was my dad's favorite underwear they liked to wear when he was lifting. So, yes.
It's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Gross. It's been a pleasure and an honor to be on here.
Oh, thanks. Please call me Terry.
Okay, Terry.
Ryan Speedo Green speaking with Terry Gross. Next week, Green will sing in La Boheme at the Metropolitan Opera. The new book about him is called Sing for Your Life. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.